This episode of Misadventures in Marketing is brought to you by the American Marketing Association, San Francisco. AMASF is a member-run organization that has been serving the Bay Area marketing community for over 80 years. Through programs, events, workshops, and discussions that introduce the latest trends and developments in the industry, to networking events that bring together the best marketing minds in the region, AMASF diligently works to foster professional learning and career advancement opportunities for all of its members. Joining is easy. To become a member of AMASF, go to amasf.org. That's amasf.org, and click on Get Involved on the top menu, then become a member. For just $199 a year, you'll get access to events, resources, credentialed learning opportunities, and a community of fellow marketers who will help you expand your network and advance your career. The AMASF membership, the investment you make for the career you love.
And when you're stuck there, like, that hurts your own thinking. You know, God, I got to make this work. What's wrong with me? I got to push harder. And you just don't realize the situation's a mess and there's no way out. The way out is to realize this is just a short chapter in your career.
Yeah.
And you're in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Hello, and welcome to the Misadventures in Marketing podcast, presented by the American Marketing Association, San Francisco chapter. I'm Steve Haney, a fractional CMO in Silicon Valley.
And I'm Peter Farrago, a high-tech marketing executive in the Bay Area. Each week, Steve and I come together to discuss all things in high-tech marketing.
We share our own experiences running marketing teams with a special focus on technology startups, our successes, our failures, what worked and what didn't. We'll also be inviting our CMO friends and other marketing colleagues onto the show every once in a while and hopefully impart some wisdom along the way. Peter, how are you?
I'm excellent. Stepping up content in a big way at the company I'm at. I was writing all weekend, so I'm in a little bit of a haze, but I feel maybe smarter. I don't know. How are you?
Okay. Actually, a lot going on the personal family end. It was a crazy week last week, but a lot of exciting stuff. Everybody achieving amazing things and moving forward in life. We move onward. So, you are driving the topic this week, and what are we discussing?
Episode 11 is entitled, When the Magic's Gone or Was Never There. Maybe a subtitle was Magical Thinking, but it has to do with an age-old problem of trying to market a product that has an issue. You know, it's either not really in demand, or it was in demand and no longer in demand, or in the startup world, you don't have what's called product market fit, or maybe you did and the market shifted. But basically, you have this expectation that marketing somehow with quote unquote messaging is just going to make it better. Have you been there ever experienced such a thing, Steve?
Can I use the old adage, trying to shine up a turd?
If you've come from the older consumer packaged goods world, this a more staid expression is when manufacturing throws it over the wall.
Back in my days in the video game industry, when we were still doing, you know, packaged goods, we did often have things thrown over the wall at us, you know, would acquire a company, there'd be a bunch of old legacy titles. And we actually would do some pretty amazing things, repackaging and putting like five discs in a set. This was the old days. Doing a deal with a major retailer like Target or Walmart, you know, the broader consumer retailers, not, you know, a GameStop or even a Best Buy, and having a budget price, like get these five old games for $15, $10. And you could, purely through marketing, meaning dealing with pricing, dealing with packaging, dealing with distribution, take products that, you know, the shine was off of them, so to speak, and produce a really good business. So there are definitely ways the marketing team can make some exciting stuff happen. Now, of course, today very different dynamic with everything being online and digital download and whatnot. There are a lot of startups that, looking at it from a VC perspective, somewhere about around the late B stage, early C stage, and they're referred to as zombies, where they never really found strong product marketing fit. Everybody kind of realizes that they're the walking dead. However, there are customers. The product is workable. It's not going to be the investment you put into them in the first place. Marketing sometimes is expected to take those kind of products and, you know, say, okay, what can we do on the price, promotion, and distribution end to try to salvage something here? Would that be accurate, or am I off on a tangent?
No, I mean, I've lived it too. I was at Electronic Arts, I've mentioned before, and I was on the Sims franchise, and I did compilation packs toward the end of the life cycle of one generation of the Sims. And
there you
go. We were doing physical distribution too through large retailers. And, you know, I think it's just a skill set you have at a certain period of time. We just aren't using those things exactly. But what I will say that I was also good at that I don't think anyone can do right now is cost accounting. I had to calculate break even and variable costs and all kinds of profit metrics to justify a business, you know, contribution margin. And, you know, like there's a totally different skill set because you're pitching an entire business. Today, I think one of the ways, if I can move it into more startups and a little more of the theme of this podcast, is people have heard the expression, a solution looking for a problem. So in tech, because often, say, a developer or somebody can just build something, or a technology comes out that is kind of cool. It's a tech demo is another pejorative term people use. What they're implying is that the person who built it is not in touch with the marketplace. You fail in this process that exists at these other more mature companies where you have to first present a business case. And then if the business case is approved, then you start going down the line all the way to product requirements doc and launch docs and stuff. And so usually there's a bigger process involved to make sure you're, quote unquote, finding a demand and then filling it instead of coming up with something and hoping it will be useful for somebody out there. And so it's a little more messy, but I still think it comes down to this basic idea that you should have a product people want. And that sounds stupidly simple, extremely hard to do. And then once you have it, keep it in that state because things change. Right now, AI is going to disrupt a lot of things, right? I think it was announced that ChatGPT is going to allow people to purchase something directly out of their chat experience, meaning you're not searching, clicking on the link, ending up at a storefront. ChatGPT will say, oh, you want to buy this right here, and you click it and you're done, all in the same session.
Right.
So that could disrupt an entire e-commerce thing. So my point is you could find something like Shopify is a good example because Shopify has been an amazingly successful company. And all of a sudden, this news that ChatGPT can just deliver the commerce experience all within the LLM could be quite threatening all of a sudden, you know?
So if we could step back, give me a better sense of what you think magical thinking looks like, and how do you know when it's rearing its head within the company?
The problem with magical thinking, I'll say up front, is that it puts people in a strange distortion field. Mm-hmm. And even if you see things correctly and try to call it out, you could get pushed down pretty hard.
I think it was Allen Ginsberg who said you have to be willing to kill your darlings. And I think especially in a lot of tech startups, at least here in the Bay Area, we've got these brilliant engineers who, referring back to what you were saying earlier, they come up with this thing and throw it out there and it doesn't quite have product market fit. And you coming on board with these founders and you're trying to bring in the market realities saying, guys, you're stuck in magical thinking. We have to get out of this mode. And they don't want to kill their darling. They have this product vision, and in some sense, it works for them. And when you start bringing in, as the business guy, either sales or marketing, the realities of what the marketplace is saying back to you, you know, you get a lot of pushback. And so the question is when you see that kind of what you're calling, I think you said delusion, I think that's a great word too.
Distortion field.
Distortion field, right? How do you approach that founder who does not want to kill his darlings.
Yeah. First off, the context you're putting us in is a good one, which is early stage with a founder. Founders have to be passionate. And there's this problem between balancing passion and objectivity. And a lot of Silicon Valley startups, much like a director, is probably the most important person on a Hollywood project. The CEO, the founding CEO, is really the most important person on the startup project. And they have run the gauntlet, usually for years, raise money. And raising money is extremely difficult. It's like a 1% of people who pitch to companies with a good pitch get like a term sheet back, right? So like there's a lot of rejection is my point. They have to do all the initial selling. So my point is that founder is very battle hardened and knows how to passionately argue for and persuade and convince and rally people around the cause. So when you get to a certain size, the way you're saying, and maybe the original idea, the thesis is somehow off and not working, that's when you get into a challenge. When the company's a little farther along, like maybe A, B, C round, here's how I think it shows up. So how do you know you're in trouble potentially in an environment of magical thinking? Magical thinking to me is when people believe the founder, whomever, the board, the executive team, your colleagues, people believe that marketing can somehow compensate for a product that just isn't working yet. And here's how I think you'll start to feel it. You'll start hearing comments like, well, we just need better messaging, or let's just do a big launch, or can't we just make this go viral, or we just need more traffic or top of the funnel, you know, or let's just rebrand. But the problem, if you go back through that list, if you need better messaging, the underlying problem is there's probably a churn issue. If you just say, let's do a launch, well, it's like, well, is the product getting traction and or is it still buggy or incomplete? You know, can you make it viral? Well, on something that nobody's using or doesn't have true virality, right? Or let's drive more traffic when no one's converting. That's a leaky bucket problem. So the magical thinking is like, just do more of the thing, you know, up front that we think will end up generating more revenue, but people don't realize that the product's not sticky, the conversion's not there. That's when you know you're in trouble. And if you have a founder who's very persuasive and stubborn, I mean, I think to be a great leader, you have to have some of that. Burn the boats. Let's go. There's no turning back.
Right. Right.
And you kind of look for it.
Peter, could I ask you to step back? What is it about the marketing guy coming in? What unique or gal, what is her unique skill set that enables her to see things that other folks on the management team can't see? Like, folks like us bring to the party where we can help break the delusion and persuade people not to drink the Kool-Aid? I would say our skill set is we're in touch with the marketplace.
I'll be honest with you. I want to be in touch with the market and I want to represent, quote unquote, voice of the customer and be able to go to add value to product conversations in a real way.
Right.
But the amount of work it takes to become an expert in a domain, because when I'm joining a company, like now I'm among a bunch of PhDs and professors who have careers in machine learning and AI and LLMs and computer science, and they're selling to a very technical audience. And so I know that I'm not going to be able to tell them, no, the customer doesn't want this, they want that. I'm not going to be able to just do that. So what happens is for me now, for example, when I'm by myself as the marketer, there's so much to do that I sort of monitor, yes or no, we have product market fit, yes or no, somebody who is influencing product that I trust is representing the customer. It's not that I'm not in touch, but my point is to really build up my gut and my compass, it takes a long time and I have to suspend disbelief to some extent. Now, in a bigger company or when there's more data available, I spent the first two thirds of my career going very heavy into marketing research, practical marketing research, and bringing back a lot of influence that way. Uh-huh. And I think that one way I think about it is who has power and influence in the company, and people who are closer to the customer do. Sales always does because they have constant contact and proximity and are touching revenue, which everybody wants. They always have a disproportionate say in what happens. The challenge with sales that I think most people understand is that often they are focused on a short-term concern a customer has by right. virtue of their work. So there's a distortion or an overemphasis on short-term needs. So what the product marketer has, to try to answer your question specifically, that what they have that others don't have from a perspective is, one is they're less attached to what investors care about and what sales needs to do in terms of delivering revenue.
We've had this discussion many times. As you know, the marketing folks, it's their responsibility to get out of the trees and look at the forest.
Let me try again, because I just feel like I fumbled that, and I feel an obligation to the audience. But I think that we use words in marketing like positioning and differentiation and messaging, and they sound like throwaway words. And I'll be honest with you, I don't love those terms because I think they've been so diluted. But the reality is, if you ask really, if someone's saying create urgency, let's push harder, let's spend on XYZ campaign or whatever, do the work for it, you have to ask yourself if the product is differentiated. If you have no meaningful differentiator, then it's not going to work. So you mentioned, is it data? Yes, it's data to an extent. Is it being an expert on the product? To the extent you can be, that it's practical and that no one else that you trust is doing a good enough job, yes. I don't think you want to cede that. I think you need that point of view, but it takes time to build up in certain domains, especially if you come in like I do, sometimes not being the expert initially. And then product is blaming sales and sales is blaming marketing. I mean, you probably know you have a problem, right? If you're just constantly being asked to make things look better instead of work better, then you're probably in magical thinking land.
So those are kind of the warning signs. Yeah, 'cause I'm just curious what they start seeing on the horizon that starts setting off the alarm bells. Like, what are those things you're seeing? Like, what are those red flags or flashpoints?
Right. But marketing is leverage, not life support. You know, if the product's not delivering value, no amount of storytelling, branding, or demand generation can save it.
Yeah.
So marketing can accelerate the truth, not manufacture it. And I think if you're...
Oh, wait, that's a great... Wait, hold on. We've got to get that into the pantheon somewhere. Say it again.
Marketing can accelerate the truth, but not manufacture it.
I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah, I think that sometimes, you know, marketers are perceived as liars and charlatans and people who will say anything to make customers try something or whatever, want something, and we're able to use some, you know, witchcraft. But the truth is, the way I've always marketed is you have to find the truth. You have to find the real need, you know, and you have to build around it.
This episode of Misadventures in Marketing is brought to you by Peak Bound Studio, the Bay Area video production house for high-impact marketing videos. Online video is quickly becoming the universal language of business and the primary medium through which marketers speak to their prospects. According to Forbes and market research firm Statista, 90% of all businesses are currently using online video in their marketing. And in 2025, 85% of those businesses will increase their spending in online video over last year. Enter Peakbound Studio. Peakbound Studio is not just another video production team. They are storytellers, visual artists, and high-tech experts rolled into one. They manage everything from the initial concept to the final edit. Your online video presence has to be responsive, vibrant, and constant to get the attention of prospects and spread your message into every corner of the marketplace. Peakbound makes sure your messages are unique, compelling, and pop in today's attention-scarce world. So whether you need brand storytelling, customer testimonials, corporate videos, or short-form social media content, Peakbound delivers videos that don't just look good, they work. Learn more at www.peakbound.studio. That's www.peakbound.studio. Peakbound Studio, the video production house that puts your online video to work.
One thing I have said to CEOs before is like, look, I can promote this thing and I can get lots of people to be aware of it and I can get lots of people to try it. but I'm just going to accelerate them figuring out this product isn't very good for them. I'm going to spend a lot of the company's money burying us faster.
Yeah, that idea that marketing is an accelerant. You know, how do you deliver this news in a way that doesn't get you fired?
I think it's got to be objective. Sometimes there's not a lot of time when you're in a small company. And so even now, I'm extremely diplomatic and polite with the guy I work for. And he's constantly telling me, hey, man, the sooner you figure out I don't have an ego, the better. But I still hold back. That said, like you, we've talked about this openly, you and I, just over coffee. But we've both pissed people off inadvertently, of course. You know, sometimes I'm just too blunt. I've gotten let go or had to leave. Usually it's mutual, but something's not working, right? And I'm already looking for the next thing because that CEO relationship's so important, especially earlier stage. But one of the reasons I like smaller companies is you can cut out the bullshit and get right to the problem and acknowledge it. Here's the truth. Let's try to solve it. Let's move forward. Bigger companies have all this extra bureaucracy and packing around it in politics, but don't go in guns blazing to your boss and complaining. If you can ask a really good question and bring really good data, this might be like more of a lesson on negotiating and diplomacy, but the short story is bring data. Drop-off rates, churn, maybe there's a number of support tickets. If you can bring customer quotes, verbatims, to ground, you know, things in reality, because you'll hear a lot of, well, I just talked to the customer, they love it. And it's like, okay, but I have these three quotes that I've heard that are concerning and are a pattern, right? Like if someone's saying, hey, I want you to do X, Y, and Z, like big push, we got to do this, we got to get revenue, I need you to have a big campaign or whatever. You don't have to say it's broken per se. You can just say, well, I don't know that we're launch ready yet. And I think we can do the following now, and I believe if we have the following other things in place or added feature set, differentiator, whatever, we can do these programs once we have that in place. So what you try to do is just not be like, yes, I'm off, I'm going to do it. Because the other challenge is like if you are being responsible for marketing and outcomes and maybe you're just an executive and you have that real responsibility or you care to have it, you don't want to just be like, sure, everybody, I'll just do it, you say. And then like 6 months later, the boat is sinking and everyone's wondering what the hell happened. And then you start blaming each other. And then you might even say, well, I kind of had a feeling that the product wasn't ready. And then people are like blaming you. Why didn't you say something? So this is something you also learn in consumer packaged goods, by the way, I'll say, that makes, I think, people savvy is when you are the vendor to a large retailer, it is always your fault. Always your fault. Even if the buyer broke your arm and made you do something, like in the worst way, at the end of the year when they're looking at the numbers with you, they might kick you out of a multi-million-dollar account because it's quote unquote your fault. It's not a CYA attitude. It's more like you have to be willing to have tough conversations even when you're scared as hell. You have to have them the right way. You have to have them the right way, though. You know, my point is, you know, learn how to agree, learn how to disagree agreeably, bring data, use customer quotes, offer this split strategy. So what you're trying to do is show that you want to move forward.
Yeah. So I just think on a practical level, there's bringing the data, there's bringing the history of where magical thinking has inserted itself into various meetings and decisions. There are the diplomatic skills, approaching the rest of the management team and saying there are fundamental issues here with the product that no amount of marketing magic or sales programs is going to fix. How can we address these things? One of the notions that keeps coming up to me, and I know you and I have gone round and round on this, but having the product manager or in my thinking, the product marketing manager, being the CEO of the product and having what I refer to as matrix management, meaning they've got a lot of responsibility, but no authority. So the product manager doesn't have anybody reporting to them. They're an individual contributor, but they have all the different functions essentially reporting into them in a dotted line. So they're not even a dotted line, right? It's matrix management. And so, you know, you and I often talk about carrots and sticks, right? And so if you're a product manager, you're like 80% carrot because you've got to get the product, the engineering guys to listen to you. You got to get the marketing guys, the sales guys, you got to get them all to listen to you because it's like, at the end of the day, it's your product and you got to make it succeed. and feeding requirements to engineering, you know, working with the MarCom team to get the messaging right, et cetera, et cetera. And that way, the kind of things you're talking about to achieve product market fit, if you've got that kind of structure in place, which I get the feeling right now at your current startup, you are very much playing that role. I mean, I know you're doing a lot of outbound, which that's understandable. And this is what you do really well, Peter, if I may say,
Thank you.
Is that you look at the whole business.
It's kind of an affliction, honestly. It's like an OCD type trait. I don't have OCD for anyone who really has it. I'm just being colloquial and silly, but it makes life hard for me. I'm not trying to say this is what makes me great. It's actually when I bring this to an extreme, it's a problem. I have to understand the big picture often. I have to know what the total map looks like to then drop in and focus on an area. It's just I feel very disoriented when I don't have a big picture framing in place or a mental map of sorts. And I think it's possibly a personality thing or how I organize things in my head. The other thing that you said early on that does resonate with me is this idea of being, I'll put it in quotes, a CEO, but being the leader of the business and the product, or a leader of the business and the product, because I do think that magical thinking in the company and maybe this inertia or momentum we all seem to have toward the edge of a cliff and no one is able to stop it. I think that you have to have alliances. That was one of the things I was thinking of when you were talking about sales. Marketing to me, especially product marketing, sits between product on one side and sales on the other. And depending on your skill set and the stage of the company or what you're good at or how you approach your job, you can be much more product the way you said. And I do understand, by the way, the distinction between product marketing and product management and how there is tremendous overlap and those titles do get a little bit mixed up. I think in tech software, it's pretty understood, and hardware, a product manager's role is pretty defined and marketing tends to be more outbound. But the long story short is you do have to think about the whole business and building up an alliance or agreement or having some trusted relationships with a good, strong product person, with a good sales leader, can make a big difference in trying to maybe talk to a CEO who is very passionate and under a lot of pressure. I think that's the other thing you have to take into consideration is some CEOs are under unrealistic pressure.
You know, my board meetings, I called them, you know, rock throwing contests. I mean, and I was, you know, I was not in a good place. It was my very first startup. I had a board that they were not bad people. They were venture investors. I had another colleague and he always said, every board meeting is a new interview for the CEO job. So every time you go in, you're being assessed. Are we keeping this guy around after this board meeting? The pressure is huge. And I fully appreciate what you're saying.
Yeah, but I'm not making excuses, right? I'm just trying to set the stage a little bit more for somebody who's got to play this role, you know, like this, a marketing person who feels stuck in a place where the product is getting rushed out to market in a bigger company. Maybe you're trying to respond to a competitive threat. Maybe you're at an earlier stage startup and you feel all this pressure to go, go, go. Maybe you're more junior in experience, or you're newer. You're much newer. Like the salesperson's been in place for 2 years and they and the CEO seem to be super tight and you're not, right? And so how do you come in and kind of understand the situation and try to steer it in a better way without being, you know, without suffering organ rejection? Now, the other way you could put it, if I take all of that, you know, wanting to get along, wanting to be light, caring so much, whatever, which is all important for reasons I'm being a little flippant. But if you just don't care, like, about anything but the truth, that could be effective too if you have a certain personality. And there's some people who are good truth bringers and people accept it. You just can't be a real jerk at the same time. Otherwise, right, they'll find a reason. You'll make yourself the problem, right? And your argument won't be heard. At bigger companies, I would actually spend a lot of time thinking about the right question to ask. And so this sounds ridiculous, but sometimes the right question is the best way to go. I was working with a very smart guy who was kind of giving me this perspective once. And so I've been constantly thinking about this in my career for the last 8 years, but it's like the best question to ask, because you want people to convince themselves in a way. So I was at a startup before this. I was at a series of startups. My last startup I was at, I then was very tension filled and one of the reasons was we had high churn on a product and there was a lot of magical thinking. It's the most magical thinking kingdom I was part of. You know, I'm trying to think about what I could have done, because in that scenario, I had a salesperson that I knew before I joined, and we were great allies. And he was cool, like down to earth, saw things correctly, great partner. I thought he was doing everything right. CEO, who's mercurial, decided he wanted to kick that guy out for whatever reason. And the guy came in, was like less experienced, but cocky, and honestly just didn't speak. He was kind of a mute, and he just ignored marketing. And the CEO was also somewhat inexperienced. And I think, you know, he was kind of an emotional guy. And I think, frankly, a little bit tactical and easily swayed by his board. And so he was influenced by the new guy. And I found myself quickly feeling like I was on the outside,
right?
You know, as far as having a say.
Definitely happens.
And it just happened. Yeah. And I knew the writing was on the wall. Like, funnily enough, you know, we built really good, effective marketing and repositioned the company, but that didn't really matter. And I think that's also a bigger lesson here, is that you can't work your way out of magical thinking. And I think in that case, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is if there's something I could have done differently. And if I was more of a truth sayer and I didn't care as much about trying to figure out how to maintain long-term relationships, I would have gone in much, much harsher and more direct.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a whole nother podcast topic you and I could talk about, in terms of being part of the team and being part of the vibes, the CEO not giving a crap about the actual data that you're delivering, and you're delivering well. It doesn't matter, because somehow you're not gelling with the team. Like, the team having to gel, and it doesn't matter how great your performance is, because there's this irrational thinking going on that you're somehow not one of the guys or the gals. So anyway, it sounds like then the one mindset shift that a marketer, and correct me if I'm wrong here, has to make to kind of see this kind of situation and respond well, and being a truth teller, as you've put it, is to come with the data, ask the right questions, and then diplomatically being able to work that with the rest of the executive management team, and then how you can then help feed the truth back to the product team to change the product so that we have product market fit, and not understand that the burden isn't on marketing to manufacture the truth and, again, put a shine on the turd. Not possible. So is that the mindset shift, or would you characterize it differently?
No, I think that's right. I think it starts with, I don't know, realistic self-awareness about what marketing can and can't do, and being willing to educate others, even if you feel like it's limiting the perceived influence and impact a marketing group can make. You have to accept and communicate your role. And I think the reason I bring that up first is, if you have a good sense of what you can and can't influence and how to do it and your role in that, then you can communicate that. And that's the foundation. Then it's about, like you said, bringing in the right data. I like to ask the questions as a tactic. This is going to sound also strange, but marketers tend to work with lawyers a lot. And I really like lawyers, mostly. Sometimes they're slowing the business down. But most of the lawyers I work with are amazing. And one thing that you learn from lawyers, really good lawyers, is they never ask a question they already don't know the answer to. So if you apply that same thinking with asking the right question, if you ask that question, you let it hang, you let people refute it, this and that. And I'd say with that, I'd add, if you're in that situation, also know that sometimes there's no winning. Sometimes it's just, sometimes the answer is, it's not the place for you in your career.
Yeah.
And that's hard. I think this is worth saying. I really don't like losing. Like, in my heart, there's a shame in it. And it makes me push all the way to the end, and sometimes irrationally. And I just think there's something wrong with me. I couldn't figure it out. Do you know what I mean?
Huh.
I mean, you have talent and you have motivation and you have contribution to make, just not here right now. This isn't the place for you. That is very hard for me anyway to sometimes see when I'm really locked in. I want to make hard things work. That's what I like to do. I want to be that person. I want to be that catalyst, and it can blind you.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Peter, Great episode. Do you want me to read us out?
Please, yes, Steve, do us the honors.
I'd like to thank our audience for listening, our editor Lorenzo Fernandez Kopeck at Peakbound Studio for making us look and sound great, our marketing maven Ian Robinson Lambert for getting the word out, Julianne Bernalis, our media advisor, Ariana Azevedo for creating our wonderful brand and our graphics, and of course, the amazing Eric Widener, president of the American Marketing Association San Francisco chapter, for presenting this podcast.
All right, Steve. Great episode. Thank you, sir.